Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today we begin with bandages, not the ones in your medicine cabinet, smart bandages. Bandages embedded with electronics and medication to speed up your healing and monitor your progress. Yuowen Jiang is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's been testing these smart bandages on animals. He's also the author of a 2022 paper about smart bandages. Welcome to All Sides. Hi.
Oh, hello, Anna.
There, yeah. So the images of these smart bandages look like flexible computer chips that are stuck onto the skin. Can you walk us through the design and the technology behind them?
So basically for a smart bandage, they're really intended to function as a normal bandage as you would normally apply them. Basically, you slap it onto your wound, but the difference is we embedded some electronic components on top of that. And the key technology behind this kind of embedding electronics into the smart bandage is called a flexible printed circuit board, or FPCB in short. And basically, this is a key driving force underneath a lot of the wearable devices, where now we can actually use wireless technologies to read out and send signals through these little chips.
So what are the little chips checking for? So if I put it on, say, a laceration, what is it going to be monitoring?
Yeah, so for our initial works, we focus on measuring some kind of the physical signals that are a proxy of how your wound is behaving. For example, we are checking things like temperature and also the resistance of the skin. So temperature is a well-known marker for inflammation, right? When you have the wound be inflamed, it's going to have a elevated temperature because the immune cells is doing its job. And for the resistance, it's actually because if your skin starts to get infected, it will start to secrete more of the fluid-like materials, which are more electrically conducting than our more like a solid state skin. So that's why we are checking these two.
And then does it send a signal? Does it have like Wi-Fi capability to send a signal to my doctor to alert them? Or how does the doctor get the information?
Yeah, so this kind of little chips, you can embed a small component like a Bluetooth, so they can actually wirelessly transmit signal to your smartphone. And obviously your smartphone is way more powerful that is connected to the Wi-Fi, so that you can upload the data to a cloud server, so that the doctors can actually remotely monitor your health status without having to visit you.
That's wild. Let me just say, like, that's wild. I assume these would be more expensive than the mermaid band-aids I have in my medicine cabinet now. So they're probably not for everyday scratches.
Yeah, obviously the price is going to be higher because all the electronics, although they are being mass produced and the cost is like a few bucks in total, but still you're not expecting to pay that much just for a single piece of bandage. So these bandages right now are mainly developed for patients that are suffering from chronic wounds, right? So they really have to take care of this wound, going to wound care centers weekly or doing regular checkups. So this is really trying to solve issues in these extreme scenarios at the moment.
And it could be for people with increased risk of infection. So people who might be immunocompromised, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's basically where you have this risk, or you are actually already dealing with severe wounds, right? You will be willing to pay those extra couple of dollars just to make your life easier and prevent potential further deterioration of your wound, which you have to pay a lot more to treat them.
You're also studying how they might be used to treat burns. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so basically in our initial work, right, so we were using electrical therapy trying to accelerate the wound healing. And obviously, this is a physical-based method and can be broadly applicable to a bunch of different wounds, right? Burning wound is no exception. And we all know burning wounds is a one of the most severe wounds that you can experience. And we show that by this kind of electrical therapy, we were able to accelerate healing in the burning wound. And in the future, we hope there can be also other ways to trying to, for example, reduce the scar tissue formation, just make your skin look like more normal after the healing process.
So maybe less of a need for skin grafts.
Exactly, right. So, or you can potentially work together with the skin graft. A big issue of the skin graft is a lot often time your skin graft may be immuno rejected by your body, and they may not have developed the blood circulation system to let them survive, right? So you can imagine developing a smart bandage that can monitor how your skin graft behave or like survive, so you can potentially make them live better, or just use the skin graft as a sensor to tell what's going on, yeah, at that wound site.
The Department of Defense is funding research on smart bandages to the tune of $55 million, and I think we kind of just got a little understanding as to why. It sounds like members of the military might hope that people injured by blasts and burns could benefit from these bandages.
Yeah, exactly. The Department of Defense is one of the key agencies that are interested in wound healing, and especially the military burns. They're not just there are different ways of soldiers getting burned: chemical burning, electrical shocking, or the regular like thermal burns. And yeah, these are all the scenarios that may potentially be benefited with this smart bandage technology.
It's also a big deal for people with diabetes. Can you walk us through why?
Yeah, so this is a interesting case, right? Oftentimes people don't necessarily link diabetes with wounds, but apparently in people suffering from diabetes, the hyperglycemia, meaning the high glucose concentration in your blood, will actually significantly impede how the tissue would regenerate if you have a wound. So oftentimes for people with diabetes at their extremity of the body, for example, the foot, they can develop a scenario called diabetic foot ulcer. And these diabetic foot ulcers are not healable. It's just because they have such a high glucose concentration in the blood vessel, inside the blood vessel. So in this case, for DFU, it is again, another very severe scenario of the chronic wounds. And in our initial work, we show that through our electrical therapy, we were able to accelerate the healing, or basically heal this kind of a non otherwise non-healable wound.
Oh, that's pretty incredible. How does electrical stimulation increase immune cells, or how does it heal a wound?
Yeah, so well, this is something that we were also interested in. So obviously, there are a couple of factors we can imagine that can go on. So first of all, right, cells are actually not insulator, right? So they're actually consisting of mostly physiological fluid. So upon the electrical field, they actually can migrate, right, along the electric field, right? So just like a charged particle. And in addition to this kind of physical aspect, right? So we show that by electrical stimulation, we can actually locally recruit immune cells to migrate to the wound site. And in particular, we've identified one kind of immune cell that shows a large change, which is called macrophage. And using some advanced transcription analysis, we show that by this electrical stimulation, we can drive the formation of a subtype of the macrophage called M2, which is the key player that is in charge of the regeneration of the tissue. So basically, through this kind of molecular transformation, we were able to use electric stimulation to promote the healing of the wound.
And then you can monitor it in real time with the
Yeah,
computer
so
chip on the
exactly.
bandage.
Yes, because that's the neat thing about having sensors and the stimulator or the actuator all in the same system. So you can imagine operating it in a closed loop manner or autonomous manner. So you don't need to actually use the manpower to do any kind of external adjustment. The sensor can sense the current status of the wound and adjust its treatment plan by itself.
So you've been testing this on rats and mice. What have been their reaction? Because it feels like Very different than testing it on a human, but I suppose we have to start somewhere.
Yeah, so obviously, mice and rats are far like pretty different from humans, but these are a good model system because we have more established wound models and also a better understanding of their genetics. But after that, we plan to go beyond on large animals, for example, pigs, which is a common model for studying wounds, and obviously on human who are already suffering from chronic wounds. But obviously, you have to go one step, step by step, and establish the baseline correlation and all these things.
Is pig skin similar to our own skin? Is that why we use pigs?
Well, it's just because, yeah, the pig skins are more similar to our skin, and also they are bigger, so you can actually create larger wounds that are similar to human wounds in terms of sizes.
One of the things I found fascinating was the University of Arizona's smart bandages. They're testing increasing blood flow to the injured tissue, which is fascinating.
Yeah, so for blood flow, obviously we know that tissue growth requires blood flow. So a better vascularized tissue means they are more they have a high chance to be regenerated better. And to study the blood flow, there are a couple of ways, right? You can imagine how you can use the blood oximeter to measure them, just like how we measured it during the COVID time, right? So if you have a wearable oximeter sensor that you can locally measure the blood oxygen level, that can use that as information to reflect how the blood vessel is forming. It will be good information to see how your skin graft or how your wound is healing.
I was going to say, it sounds like that would be critical for burn patients.
Exactly.
So, when do you hope to begin human trials?
So we're actually working with a doctor at Yale Medical School right now, and we are actually trying to get our IRB approved and get into measuring signals on patients that are actually regularly visiting the wound care center over there.
Do you have any estimate on how long this just how long before smart bandages become part of our medical care, before you could get one in a hospital?
Well, I guess there are a couple of barriers that we have to overcome, right? So first of all is a reimbursement code, right? So how you can
Because insurance
have
has got to pay for it.
how you can have FDA approve a smart bandage as a part of a medical device that insurance companies are going to pay for that, and also other things are from a technology side, right? So how you can make sure the materials are all cleared and approved, right? How to reduce the manufacturing costs. So these are the things that we're considering before pushing it into the real market.
So it sounds like a couple of years down the
Yes,
line.
yes.
You know, the chairman of the surgery department at the University of Arizona College of Medicine was quoted in the Wall Street Journal article saying, quote, "We are practicing medieval medicine in wound care. There hasn't been a lot of innovation." Do you feel like that's accurate, that this is sort of a big leap forward in an area that we haven't invested in?
Yeah, I guess
It might be
that's
hyperbole for the article, but
yes,
it was a good
yes.
quote.
That's true.
Yeah, because I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, I'm still bandaging my kids up essentially the way I was bandaged up and the way probably my mother was bandaged up.
Yeah, so exactly the wound care is actually a very old topic, and it's but it's like almost a like nothing changed over the years. It's just because how the technology is basically stagnated on that side. But in the recent years, because of all this data-driven research and also the advancement of semiconductor manufacturing, we were able to miniaturize all these electronic components, which are considered smarter than a passive material. So now it's that's why it's the time. We see a lot of see a booming trend of having all these kind of different wearable electronics being applied into different medical devices, which were previously or mostly passive.
That makes sense. You had to wait for the computer technology to get small enough and flexible enough to work in this design.
Yes, exactly. It's just like how your personal computer goes from the the bulky size to a laptop and now to a smartphone. Yeah.
That was Yuowen Jiang, an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's developing our first smart bandages for humans. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Coming up, the effort to bring two astronauts back to Earth. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our second story is about space. Two astronauts are still stuck at the International Space Station. Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams were supposed to come home earlier this month, but they've been delayed until at least July because of problems with their ride home. Former astronaut and International Space Station commander Leroy Chow remains cautiously optimistic about their predicament.
So, like I said, my gut feeling is that everything's okay with the spacecraft. Butch and Sonny can come back on that spacecraft, when it's deemed to be appropriate. But, NASA could really help itself by giving more information out in this case.
Joining me now to get as much information as we know about what's going on with Boeing's Starliner is Eric Berger, a Houston-based senior space editor at Ars Technica. He's also the author of the 2021 book, Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. Welcome to All Sides, Eric.
Thanks, Anna.
So engineers continue to test and repair the Starliner, but the spaceship had issues before it left Earth. What went wrong before the launch?
Well, it's been a long road for Starliner, and there have been lots of different issues. I guess probably the most significant issues within the last year or so before launch were a problem with flammable tape inside the spacecraft. Boeing and NASA had to go in and remove miles, essentially, of this tape from the vehicle and replace it. This was insulation inside the spacecraft. And then they had some issues as well with the parachutes that are used to slow the spacecraft down when it returns to Earth. Those were both resolved within the final months before launch this summer. In the last weeks before liftoff, there was a problem with a helium leak, a single leak. NASA and Boeing decided that it was safe to launch the vehicle in that configuration. They thought it was manageable. But after Starliner launched into orbit, they found four additional leaks. And so those problems have magnified. As Leroy just said, these don't appear to be showstoppers, but there are concerns that NASA's watched very closely.
And that's why they've delayed bringing them back.
Yeah, it was the helium leaks. And also, as they were approaching the International Space Station, five of the thrusters on board the vehicle, there's 28 of these small thrusters that are used to basically maintain Starliner's attitude and do fine maneuvering. Five of these failed. They were able to recover four of them. One is still off. And so they've been really closely studying this issue since Starliner's been docked to the space station.
So what happens if they can't fix the leaks or if they can't fix the thruster? Will they be able to make the trip home?
Yeah, they're going to probably, I think essentially they're working through the paperwork and studying all the scenarios to make sure that they can come back to Earth safely. The fact of the matter is that they, despite the leaks, they have enough helium to get through the maneuvering to come back to Earth, and they're more than capable of operating with one faulty thruster. So these are manageable problems. They really want to study them, though, because they want to make sure that these issues don't crop up on future Starliner missions.
Here's an obvious question, but it's one that I had, is do Butch and Sonny have enough food and water on the International Space Station? Basically, Are they okay up there?
Yeah, they're okay. So the space station is supplied primarily by different vehicles. There's a cargo version of SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft. There's a cargo version of a spacecraft called Cygnus that is launched by Northrop Grumman. And so those vehicles arrive at the station every several months, bringing ample food and water. And you know, any given time, the station has 3 to 6 months of excess food on orbit just for these such these contingencies. There were several years ago in the past where both of NASA's crew vehicles were off, or cargo vehicles were offline, so they had to rely on Russians basically for some emergency supplies. But yeah, they'll be fine.
No, that's good to know. So they're just kind of hanging out, waiting for the all clear to go home.
You know, they're chilling out there, but they're also doing work. The fact of the matter is the space station is now more than 20 years old. Parts of it are a quarter of a century old. There is a lot of maintenance work to be done, lots of things to be moved around, experiments to do. And so they are filling in. They're helping the on-orbit astronauts, you know, with their tasks. And they're also helping NASA get data about the vehicle. One of the things that's important to understand about Starliner is that you've got the crew capsule where the astronauts are, and then you've got a service module which provides majority of the thrust. That's where these problems have occurred, is in the service module. But when they come back to Earth, the crew separates from the service module. The service module burns up in the atmosphere. And so at that point, NASA will have no ability to study, you know, what's gone wrong. And so they're collecting as much data as they can now before that vehicle's lost.
Oh, that's so interesting. They're making them wait because they want to better understand the problem before the evidence disappears.
That's right. They won't be able to study these problems on the ground when the capsule comes back.
What can you tell us about Sonny and Butch? Like, who are they?
They're two of NASA's more experienced astronauts. You know, if you go back and look at the space shuttle program, that vehicle stopped flying in 2011, which is hard for me to believe, but that's been 13 years now. Butch is one of, if not the final pilot that flew a space shuttle. It's like all the commanders have retired. And the pilot who also had stick time on the shuttle, I think he may be the last pilot. So like, he's a very experienced astronaut, and SUNY has been around in the program for decades as well. So these are very qualified people who have lots of experience in space flight. And we saw Butch taking control of Starliner a lot during the approach to station when they were having problems with these thrusters. You know, his flying experience really came to the fore. So they're great people to sort of, they understand that this, you know, this is a test flight. I'm not sure they expected quite all of these problems to occur, but they're certainly, you know, capable of handling them.
I think when we think of accidents or problems going wrong with spacecrafts, in most of us think of Apollo 13 because of Tom Hanks and the portrayal of that mission in movies. But it sounds like this situation is not parallel to the situation that the Apollo 13 astronauts faced.
Yeah, I'd be shocked at this point if NASA has to send a rescue mission. It could do so with a SpaceX Crew Dragon vehicle, but that's very unlikely to happen. The fact of the matter is that Starliner is, you know, in all probability flyable. They're just taking some extra time to make sure they get everything right and get the data that they need. But you know, the fact of the matter is spaceflight is inherently risky. And, you know, these thruster issues that we've seen on this flight cropped up on the previous flight of Starliner, an uncrewed flight to the space station. And so NASA really needs to make sure that they understand these problems, because apparently they were not fixed after the first test flight.
The U.S. Space Agency sounds like it's counting on the success of the Starliner mission to provide these commercial vehicles for crew transport to the International Space Station. So they're really betting on getting this right with the Starliner.
Yeah, they're fortunate because, you know, for a long time when we were flying the space shuttle, that was the only way we had to get astronauts into orbit. Since 2020, NASA has been able to rely on SpaceX and Crew Dragon, which has flown more than a dozen operational missions since its debut. And there have been some problems with Dragon. I don't think anything that rises to the level of what we've seen here, but there's been some parachute hiccups and, you know, some problems with the toilet and things like that, which are, you know, always fun. But they have some luxury because they can take their time with Starliner because they have Dragon waiting. Like, Dragon can continue to fly 2 crewed missions a year for NASA seemingly without problem. And in fact, we're likely to see 10 operational missions by Dragon before we see the first operational Starliner mission, perhaps next year.
So which one is going to be the one that takes us to Mars?
Well, that's a great question. None of the vehicles that NASA's building right now are at all capable of going beyond the moon. The Orion spacecraft that we hear a lot about is definitely just a vehicle for lunar orbit. It's not really big enough to go further. You know, the vehicle that SpaceX is building, Starship, is the one rocket and spacecraft that we have coming that theoretically is capable of going to Mars. Certainly, it's large enough and it was designed for that purpose, but it has a long way to go.
So it's still in the early phases.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, because a couple of weeks ago, months ago, we talked about the psychological testing that's going on to see whether people can live together and like how they will function in these small confined spaces for 2 years at a time.
Yeah, I mean the psychology of deep space exploration is something that is just as challenging alongside the physical health risks from radiation, bone loss, eyesight deterioration. I mean, there's lots of challenges of deep space flight that we haven't really probed. I do think one of the benefits of Starship is that it's a large enough vehicle that you wouldn't have like the cramped confines that you have. We all remember the pictures of like the Apollo spacecraft, right? Or even Gemini, which they were really packed in there like sardines. Starship is much bigger. It would be more like the International Space Station in that the people flying on board that vehicle would be able to spread out a little bit more. But I'm not sure that it alleviates some of the psychological issues you talked about. I mean, what is it really going to feel like to be an astronaut in that vehicle, looking back at Earth and seeing this shrinking blue dot in the distance and knowing that maybe you're coming home? Maybe you're not, but like everything you've ever known is flying away in the window.
I imagine my astronauts feel that now as they head off into space, right? It's never a guarantee. It feels more dangerous than driving your car down the street, or at least I imagine it would.
Absolutely. I mean that, it's space flight. NASA, the commercial providers, try as hard as they can to make it safe, but it's inherently a risky exercise, right? When you're sitting on a rocket, you're essentially sitting on a controlled bomb, in terms of the explosive power of that vehicle. The International Space Station is kind of a nice testing ground, though, because it's really close. It's only a few hundred miles up in the sky. You can have high definition video calls with your family as much as you want. You're connected to the internet. You can watch TV. I mean, it's not like you're still connected to home. You can look out the window every day and see it. Going to Mars psychologically is a whole different ball game.
Yeah, it'll take, what is it, 10, 15 minutes for communication, sometimes longer.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on where Mars and Earth are in their respective orbits. It could be less than that. It could be up to 20 minutes. So you really can't have a conversation like that. You have to record video messages, I would think. And that too, obviously, is challenging. The astronauts would be very much more on their own. Like right now, if there's an emergency, you call down to mission control and say, "Hey, we need some help with this," or more likely they've noticed it first. But if you're like, the time lag is 10 or 15 minutes on your journey to Mars, and something really bad happens, you're very much on your own.
Yeah. It seems like maybe that's why we're doing so much testing with this Starliner, trying to work out all the kinks, trying to make sure we've thought through all the problems before we start launching people to a place where we really can't help them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, it's important to note too that there are just two astronauts on this vehicle. That's Butch and Sonny. Starliner carries a crew complement of four people, and there are not four people on this mission because it is a test flight. Things could go wrong, and so I don't want to be crass, but they're risking two lives instead of four for that very reason. Just like with the first space shuttle mission, you had a pilot and a commander, and no one else on a vehicle that could fly seven people.
Oh, I can't imagine being the test pilot for a spacecraft. That takes a certain kind of nerve.
It does take a certain kind of steely-eyed person, right? That I'm not sure I have that as well. But there is a breed of pilot and person who loves that, not taking that risk, but I guess embracing that challenge. You get the glory of going first, but I think also there's a great pride in sort of pushing things forward.
So when do we think Sonny and Butch are going to come back home? What is NASA's best guess?
So they haven't, it's interesting. Previously, they've set a couple of dates for return and then pulled back, kind of like Lucy kicking, pulling the football away. So they have not, with this latest update, They have not put a date out there. I think they want to be pretty certain on a date before they set it. I do think that probably the most likely date's July 4th.
Okay.
But we'll see.
What do they have to do first? Like, what's going to signal to NASA, okay, it's time, we're good to go?
Well, what will happen is the people on the spacecraft will collect all the data that NASA and Boeing think that they need. Then they'll have a mission management team meeting. I don't know if that's going to happen this week or early next. And then basically all of the program officials, all the way up to the associate administrator of NASA, a gentleman named Jim Free, will basically decide, okay, we're ready to come home. They'll set a date, everyone will sign off on it, and then they'll come back. And I don't think they'll announce a date until that happens.
And worst case scenario is they'll send somebody else, maybe SpaceX, up to go get them.
Yeah, in the very worst case scenario, which I have to emphasize, is not a high probability outcome. You know, there's this SpaceX Dragon ready to launch in August. It has four crew members, but they could take two people off that vehicle, quickly build some spacesuits, and just fly two people up and bring Butch and Sonny back home in that Dragon spacecraft.
Well, we'll all be watching and waiting to see what happens. But thank you so much for all of your great information. That was...
Sorry, it's been my pleasure, Anna.
Yeah, that was Eric Berger, a Houston-based senior space editor at Ars Technica. He's also the author of the book Liftoff, about the rise of the commercial space vehicle, SpaceX. Coming up, science fiction isn't just a great read. It could be a key to communicating the complexities of your research. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber. Scientists deal with complex issues at granular levels. And while that specialization can lead to great discoveries, it can also create experts who can't really explain what they do. Carlo Quintanilla is a health science policy analyst and a molecular biologist. I cannot talk today, let alone explain things. Carlo's recent article at science.com is called How Science Fiction Helps Me Become a Better Science Communicator. Welcome to All Sides, Carlo.
Good morning, Anna. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm not doing such a great job of communicating this morning, but we will persevere and keep
that
going.
That is the theme today.
So you had this line in your article that as soon as I read it, I knew I wanted to have you on the show. It was, the more absorbed I became in practicing science, the more I felt I was losing touch with the bigger picture of why it matters. And as someone who interviews people for a living, I think that's so true. I have talked with dozens of incredibly smart people who were terrible at explaining what they did for a living. And I don't think knowing a lot about a subject translates into being able to explain that subject.
Yeah, I think it's two sides of the coin. And a scientist's role is to become the expert and to really dive into the details and try to derive some truth through experimentation. But when you spend so much time doing that, it can be possible to lose the broader picture. And so I think, you know, many scientists, they read the literature, they do talks, they connect with different audiences. There are many ways that you can gain that perspective again. But it is, you have to make an effort to reconnect and to think about how your science can apply.
And you really jumped off the deep end with this one. You agreed to talk about the science behind the Dune book series at a convention center in Arizona.
Yes.
And those are books with a true cult following.
Yes.
Were you nervous?
I was. And Dune is very challenging from a scientific perspective. I have been new to science fiction. And so, you know, there's some concepts in there that I was able to explore related to genetics, for fans of the show know that there's a lot of genetics involved with the Bene Gesserit. They control a lot of things in the shadows, and they have these genetic programs. So as a biologist, I was able to speak to some of those concepts. And, you know, that's kind of what I've been doing, is exploring concepts presented in science fiction and try to dissect them and explain what is the reality of the science in our world.
What was the reaction to that first lecture on the genetics in Dune?
There was a lot of engagement. I was very happily surprised that there were so many questions. There was a lot of engagement from the audience. And, you know, I think it's most people hadn't read the entire series, but they are familiar at least with the first couple of books. And so the concepts that we talked about, we focused in on the first couple of books. But there was a lot of engagement. And most of the best questions for these types of talks tend to come from the younger audience members. Kids really have a lot of the best questions, I have to say.
Because I think a lot of people who like science fiction like science. I think it's a natural outlet for the creativity. You're interested in how things work, and then you're interested in imagining how they could work in the future.
Yes. I think for most people that I know, they have started with science fiction and that garnered interest in science. For me, I didn't grow up reading science fiction. I didn't talk about this in the piece, but I didn't like reading too much at all. I think the way reading was presented to me was sort of like a task. You know, so I avoided it, and it wasn't until much later. I loved science, and I came back to science fiction, and now, you know, trying to combine the two. But for most people, I think they start with science fiction, and it's an easy way, an entryway to be introduced to scientific concepts, and then you become curious and you want to explore and really figure out how things work.
Yeah, I think that's such a natural evolution for a lot of young folks. Because books fundamentally are about communicating ideas, perspectives, histories. I also think I've learned a lot about how to describe things for a radio audience from books, because they rely on visual imagery to create that movie in your head, which is something I have to do as well. You know, we talked earlier about smart bandages, and I had to think about how I would describe a smart bandage to someone who doesn't have a photo in front of them.
Interesting.
Which is essentially what you do in a book.
Yeah. And it makes you think about different ways to describe to different audiences too. So you can think about a same concept, but how would you explain it to different groups of people? And so, you know, this has really helped me doing these comic conventions and talking to audiences that I probably would have never reached before. What are things that interest them, and how can I introduce a scientific concept that way?
Without a science background, one of the things you write about is that bubble where everyone
yes.
knows your acronyms, everyone knows your shorthand, everyone knows your technical terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, you know, I hope that this piece inspires some scientists to find new ways to step outside that bubble. There are many ways to do it, to regain that perspective. So for some people, it's connecting with the lives that the science has impacted. If you're in the health sciences, you can find ways to volunteer and things like that. But for me, science fiction was a way to think about concepts and sort of testing their boundaries. What are the ethics involved? What's the context in which those stories were crafted? What's the history behind those stories, and how they fit into the larger picture again?
And sometimes science fiction becomes science. We were dreaming about traveling through space long before the first rocket ever left Earth.
That's right. That's right. Yes, that's always great to see. And you know, a lot of people think that science fiction is sort of just taking a concept and extrapolating out to its logical conclusion. But Ursula K. Le Guin, she, in an essay she wrote many
years
ago.
She's one of my favorite science fiction writers, but go on.
She's wonderful. She has a great quote that I like. Science fiction is not predictive. It is descriptive. So she makes the argument that the role of the science fiction writer is not to just take a technology and flash forward into the future and see what it'll look like. It's a reflection of our world now, our values, the context that we live in now. So it's a story about us in this moment. And I really like that, because yes, it's fun to think about concepts and see what they might be in the future. But really, when you look back at older science fiction stories, you see how the framing is done based on the context, the history, what's going on, the political dynamics of the time too, really frame how we view the science.
I have a difficult question then. Do you have a favorite science fiction book or series?
I have two. So my favorite science fiction series is The Three-Body Problem. which in this
Which
piece
is
that I
now a
wrote in
Netflix
Science,
series.
exactly, yes, and it's great. I'm loving it so far. The books were absolutely incredible. You know, it's exploring life on other planets and huge investments in science, and that scientific knowledge is not necessarily neutral. It's how it's applied. But what I loved about it most was the scale of the series, and I won't say much to
No
about
spoilers.
the no spoilers. Yes, no spoilers. But the scale of the story is massive. It spans many, many, many years. So that's one. Another is 2001: A Space Odyssey, which is a classic. And you know, I wish I had read it much earlier on. I probably would have been a science fiction fan for many years already before. And the same thing with 2001: A Space Odyssey. It's the time scales that really impress me. It's a narrative. It's a story that you're following over many, many years, many lifetimes.
Yeah. I will say I have a The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy will always be a
Yes.
nostalgic favorite for me, probably because I read it as a teenager, so it always has that special place.
Yes, I'm still working on that series, but so far the first two books are great. They're hilarious.
Yeah, it's so fun. He has so much fun with language and fun with the descriptions of the most outlandish circumstances that you might encounter traveling the universe.
Oh, definitely. Maybe I should add that series on my next talk that I could do.
Oh, I would love to hear about the science behind the Big Bang Burger Bar and Milli Ways, the restaurant at the end of the universe.
Oh, that would be a fun panel. We can definitely put one together with some of my colleagues
Because
that have done some of these talks as
time travel is in there, and time travel is a huge part of the science fiction genre. And
Oh,
it's
definitely.
one of those questions that I think every science fiction fan somewhere in their heart of hearts wonders if maybe somehow it might be possible.
That's right. That's as a biologist, it kind of escapes me. The physics of how that might be possible is completely out of my realm, but I love to read about it as well.
You know, I think the essence of what you're doing, what you're describing, is trying to meet people where they are. And that can be hard when you become an expert because sometimes when you're so full of all of the knowledge, you have no idea where to start.
Yes, I agree. And so I've done a few of these talks in different parts of the country, and I realize that when I do them at different conventions, I find that topics that are audience members have different topics that are most important to them. So when I did this one in Arizona, a lot of folks are interested in water rights, water conservation, and so a lot of that props up in the questions that people are interested in. I've done some out in Washington, D.C., and they're a lot more policy oriented. So it really forces me to think about the audience and what's most important about, as you said, meeting people where they are, what's important to the community that you're visiting, and how can you make the science interesting, of course, as accurate as possible, as entertaining as well, and find ways that they can plug in, make them feel that they can be a part of the discussion regarding ethics of science and the advancement of technologies.
It reminds me of this story, and I'm not 100% sure of the accuracy of the details, but I've always loved it, is that when DNA was first being used by law enforcement, there was this real concern among prosecuting attorneys about how to convey the science of DNA to a jury. Nowadays, we sort of have the opposite problem where, you know, all of these shows make it seem like everything is all tied up and perfectly presentable. But at the beginning, you know, 40, 50 years ago, we didn't know what DNA was. We didn't know how it worked. We didn't know why it would mean it could only come from you. And these prosecuting attorneys went around to like schools, to like middle schools and elementary schools, and tried explaining it to children because they figured if they could get that right, then they could explain it to a jury who's only going to hear the argument once.
Oh, that's great. And I agree with that. You should be able to explain a difficult concept in its simplest terms. I think that shows that you really understand it when you can describe something in the most simplest terms, and your audience can then explain it back to you in those simple terms. I think that's it's a difficult skill to acquire, but one that I think scientists we should all or communicators in general learn to refine that skill.
It is very hard as somebody who's gravitated towards wonky and complex topics. Sometimes you want to bang your head against a wall because you just think to yourself, there is no easy way to explain this.
Yeah, and when it comes to to DNA, you know, the genetic code, when that was cracked, translating those four letters that make up the genome repeated over and over 3.2 billion times, you know, that was, you can explain that concept. But now what's even more challenging is all of the other layers related to how a genome is structured. So people are putting together new analogies to expand how we can describe how DNA works.
How much does analogy and metaphor play into your descriptions? Because I think it's, I personally think it's such a great way of using something people understand to explain something that they don't.
I rely on analogy a lot. So again, with DNA, I like to use the analogy or metaphor of a restaurant. So you have menus in a restaurant. You can think of the menu as the genome, the genetic material in your cells. That menu will stay the same. If you want to make, I guess if you take an order, right, that would be how the message is transcribed in a cell as RNA. Once the order is taken over to the kitchen and it's made as a product, as you know, hamburger or pizza, that's the final product. That's the biology that's converted. So I tend to use this analogy a lot of the menu, the order, and then the final product. And there are many ways that you can change that, many ways that that order can be messed up along the way, and you have mutations in DNA or mutations, effects in the cell.
Oh my gosh, I love that. It makes so much sense because you're like, yeah, if the cook gets it wrong, then you get the wrong thing. If the waiter isn't fully paying attention, then you get the wrong thing. And I can picture that. I love that. I have so many more questions about how science works all of a sudden that I would love to hear you give analogies for.
Right.
One of the things that you have given a discussion about is mind controlling microbes.
Yes, that was a panel that I was on for exploring The Last of Us. If you're familiar with the show, The Last of Us, and it was a game before that. So in that world, there's a fungus that takes over essentially the world, and it's sort of like a zombification of the host. So we got to explore various other organisms that have parasitic behaviors, that they control the behavior of organisms. There's it's not a fungus, but Toxoplasma gondii, which is makes its way in popular culture. This organism completes its life cycle in the gut of felines, cats, house cats.
Mm.
And so, but they can, cysts can live in the tissues of different organisms, and in certain organisms like rodents, it's shown that it can affect their behavior. So they tend to be less fear. They have less fear, fear aversion.
Ah, so they get eaten by the cat.
Exactly. Yeah.
Isn't that how rabies works too? That it alters your brain in certain ways.
Similar fashion. Yeah, that there is a behavioral effect, right? And then it alters the behavior of the organism, allowing the organism to be able to complete its life cycle in some way.
Yeah, there's something about
fascinating
that
stuff
that is just inherently creepy and perfect for a science fiction book.
Yeah, and exactly, and it made for a great video game and a great show with lots of concepts to explore there.
You know, in a post-COVID, post-pandemic world, do you think that science communication is even more critical, particularly when it comes to helping people understand new medicines or vaccines that they might otherwise be hesitant about?
Yes, I think science communicators and scientists have big challenges right now and in the future. I think that there is perhaps issues with trust, you know, with distrust of science or institutions. And so I would say we need to lean in more to have conversations with the public to figure out, again, meeting people where they are and figuring out what's important to different communities, to have open, transparent discussions about various topics, not just related to parasitic or diseases and viruses, but just across the board, invite people to participate, have broad stakeholders involved. But it is a challenge.
Even when it comes to climate change, I mean, I still hear people joke about, oh, solar panels don't work when it's cloudy out. And instinctively, I want to respond with, do you need a flashlight on cloudy days? Because if you don't, I bet there's still sunlight.
Yeah. Climate change is a big one, too. I've had colleagues that have been on similar panels. And sometimes I hear the sentiment of, you know, not wanting to give a talk or go to a certain part of the country because they think that folks won't want to listen to them because they might already have their minds made up. I say you should lean into communities that maybe invite a little back and forth, and maybe talk with people who maybe disagree with you. I think that's important. We need to be able to talk about concepts and disagree a little bit and find out what we can agree on. So climate is one that I would suggest folks to get out and talk with people and see, really see what their concerns are, what their doubts are, and explain it to them in ways that make sense to them.
That's Carlo Quintanilla, a health science policy analyst and molecular biologist. His recent article in science.com was titled "How Science Fiction Helped Me Become a Better Science Communicator." Thank you so much for the conversation this morning.
It was great. Thanks for having me on, Anna.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.